don't talk about black and white with an image off a con. The BBC used to have a compass marker on the floor where you actually aligned and adjusted the camera while the camera was facing north, so the local magnetic fields would even cause geometry changes in the tube. But that's like the 50s and the 60s. As we got later on, we went to the Vidicons and the Plumicons. Those kinds of sensitivities disappeared, but we had things called shading and other types of effects where they tried to create as stable a circuit as you could, but usually when you turn the camera off, you turn it back on, it was somewhat close to what it was, but it wasn't exactly the same thing. So you, the video operator, when we're talking about broadcast, let me write it down. We're talking about broadcast cameras. The real magic is the man who sits behind the console that adjusts, tweaks the camera every time the camera person points at a different object or a different scene, because even the aberrations of the light, the angle at which the light hits the lens, even though there are achromatic coatings on the lenses, it actually changes the way the optics behave in terms of colorimetry and the amount of light that hits the target of the tube. And the tubes now have the effect of blooming, whereas you got a contrast range of basically 250 to 1, or 256 to 1, if you break it down in 8 bits. And that was the range in which the tube could handle. They also had another issue called dark current, which was all about noise, and the way they kind of fooled that is by having a bias light, whereas we actually put a little bit of light on the target so it was never completely black, and it would never make the maximum amount of noise. Today's CMOS-type sensors, or MOS sensors, they do very well, as you know, from the pictures that you get from the Hubble Space Telescope, and that's a bit of an older technology in terms of sensors, although they do a lot of math to remove noise, but the sensors itself are pretty darn quiet, and the dark currents are high in terms of the individual cell, but the actual amount of noise that they make is pretty darn low. And today's cameras, when you turn them off and switch them back on, they're exactly where you left them. K2RIW, K2 again.
You said the detector is a MOS, metal oxide semiconductor. Would I be correct in assuming that that is a kind of charge-coupled device, Eric, go ahead?
Well, if you want to go in the purest sense, a bit different. But, yeah, in a general sense, you can call them CCDs. But the principles are a little bit different.
Could you give us a couple of words on what their difference is and then go over to John? You got it, Eric.
CCDs in the traditional sense have you can think of them as a bucket brigade, number one, whereas charge-coupled devices have also been used as delay lines. The actual photosensitive properties of the charge-coupled device is basically taking photons and charging the capacitor, and essentially each cell is like a sample and hold, and you clock them across. Today's MOS type or CMOS type sensors similar in structure in terms of the optical charging a capacitor, but in essence each individual cell is clocked out and each individual pixel has an address, and also there's been major improvements in terms of the sensitivity and noise of the cell because it doesn't operate at the same voltages. The dark current's a little better. I don't remember why. I think it has to do with the way the semiconductor layer itself is made, where the junctions are a little quieter. And there's a whole lot of schemes where the battery will store a frame worth of video and then clock that out and transfer that into memory. The thing will not read sequentially. It'll actually read as a parallel processor, so to speak. Back to you, Dick.
You're getting very close to a question that Wesley has asked many times. how does a photon hit a photocoupled sensing device, in the case of a charge-coupled device, change the charge? How does the photon get coupled, get converted into a voltage on a capacitor? Is that the photoelectric effect? In a vacuum, I'd believe it, but you're not operating in a vacuum, so I'm a little confused here. How does the photon change the amount of charge on that individual capacitor that is a pixel? Over to you, Eric.
So, the capacitor is a secondary thing. You're actually controlling the amount of current through a junction, which in turn charges the capacitor, which has another FET on high impedance on the other side of it, so it doesn't bleed the charge off, and it acts as a sampling hole until you reach it. But the actual physics of the photon hitting this metal oxide surface actually causes an electron to be given off, and that electron is actually amplified and used to charge the capacitor, so to speak.
That sounds very much like a photoelectric effect, or a little bit similar to the first step of a photomultiplier, which normally operates in a vacuum. I didn't think the charge-coupled devices required a vacuum. Over to you, Eric.
They don't. It actually happens in the doping layers of the semiconductor. I was going to say, if you think about a photomultiplier or the original image opticon tube, which the back end is a photomultiplier, but it's an electron multiplier. Essentially, you have a target. You hit the target with the photon. It, in turn, gives off an electron, and then you capture that through a dynagrid assembly, and you accelerate it.
You've got it, John.
Eric, my question is in depth of field. Is that still left strictly up to the optics, or have they had any advancements in the electronics to help along with that?
Now you're talking about optics, but in the cameras of today, even in your still cameras, we have the way to be able to determine where is focused and where is not. So that's how you have autofocusing stuff. And actually, if you want to turn into the frequency domain, you will find that when you hit focus, okay, if you were looking at the picture on a spectrum analyzer, it'll go from a very narrow blob to something that looks like a comb filter that's all split up and is very broad in frequency response. But as far as depth of field goes, that's all about light passing through an aperture and saying how can I explain that? Because the tighter the aperture, you have less depth of field, whereas your focus will be, if you're looking at a scene and you have, say, a person standing in front and the background's a bit further away, you will actually get a distinct focus on the person. The background will be somewhat out of focus, whereas when the aperture is completely open, you actually will be able to keep both the background and the foreground in focus, but you got to consider how much light is passing through that, which is, you know, having an effect on the sensor, because the sensor itself only has so much dynamic range.
Yeah, there's some chance, Eric, that you may have said that backwards. In the case of ordinary optical camera, the f-stop, if I go to f1, I've got a very narrow depth of field. If I go to f16 or f22, I've got a very large depth of field. I could, in theory, at F22, I could focus at everything from 3 feet to infinity. And so, maybe that's what you were saying. But is the depth of field of something that the camera operator or the studio operator is able to dial in what depth of field he wants for that particular scene? Over to you, Eric.
Negative. It's something that we actually do in a studio to keep everything in focus. What we do is we actually adjust the light, and we want the aperture to be open. The reason for that is that the wider that is, we usually run the cameras around F4. As we tighten up the aperture, as we bring it up to F8 and F12, when you're dealing with subjects that don't have a huge amount of space between the foreground and background, you get a shift in focus. Whereas when it's open, the objects stay in focus. I know it's the opposite of what you're saying, Dick, but that's the way it works.
Are you talking about one of the side effects of a zoom lens? I know there's many a zoom lens, as you zoom in and zoom out, where its focus tends to shift a little bit. Go ahead.
That's also a factor. But if you want to keep everything in the foreground in focus, all right, you want that aperture to be, if you want both the foreground and the background to be in focus, you want that aperture to be as open as you can possibly have it.
When you make the aperture that you can adjust open as much as you can, letting in as much light, is the automatic adjustment of the camera downrange a kind of a diaphragm that is closing down, therefore giving you greater depth of field? Over to you.
Negative. What we do is we reduce the amount of light on the scene, on the subject.
The way a human eye works is that in bright sunlight, my iris closes down and I've got tremendous depth of field. At nighttime, when my iris is wide open, I've got to very carefully focus, and an awful lot of things I want to focus on, I no longer can focus on if my lens doesn't have enough adaptive, what do they call it now? Compensation, adaption, you know what I mean. So, in the case of a human eye, bright light gives you great depth of field because of the way the iris closes down. Over to you, Eric.
Okay. So let's explain what depth of field is. Now, it took me a lot of years to get this thinking right, you know, because I always just think exactly what you're saying. But if you think about it, you'll see that it's a bit different. What is depth of field? How are you describing it?
I could simplistically say I'm going to take a standard distance to the subject. I'll pick a number, 6 feet. If I've got a very broad depth of field, I'll see everything from 1 foot to infinity, even though I'm focused at 6 feet. If I've got a very narrow depth of field, the lens open wide open, and it's an f.9 lens, I might focus on everything from 5.8 to 6.2 feet. Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Okay, so when you have a studio that maybe the distance between the foreground and the background is, say, 10 feet, 15 feet, how does that get affected if you stop the lens down?
If the camera is always sitting 20 feet away and the subjects always move in a cell that's only 10 foot deep, life gets a lot simpler as far as the maximum and minimum ratios are concerned. Is that sort of what you're saying here, Eric? Go ahead.
Mr. Molson.
Yeah, it is. And also, the camera's never 20 feet away. It's more like 3 feet away, 5 feet away.
Wow. You got it, Eric. I mean, John.
Eric, also in the studio, you have great benefits with your lighting. So I assume that you also can light the foreground differently than the background. So therefore, you'd be able to adjust your lens openings and keep a great focal distance. Did they play with that also?
All right. There's a big difference between movies and television. In television, we tend to light things very flat, very evenly, which makes it rather difficult to create mood. It's not very often that you will see high contrast. I mean, if you look at Charlie Rose, and you know, that's a table where everything is fixed and they only light the people in the background. It's completely dark, but it's completely black. So there's nothing to be seen in the black. Movies are a different story. Every time they do a shot, they may take 2 or 3 hours setting up that shot, doing the lighting for that shot, measuring precisely to the inch the distance between the lens and the subject. If you ever look at the movie credits, you'll find there's somebody listed as a focus puller. He's a guy who actually pulls the tape measure that's built into the front of the lens to see how far it is, so he can set the focus on the lens. They will, in fact, depending upon the kind of mood their client creates, they may use 300, 400, 500, 600 foot candles worth of light reflecting off the subject. If you go to David Letterman's studio and you look at the Letterman show, there's barely 20-foot candles of light in that place. It is lit so dimly, it's amazing. I mean, the audience can hardly see the stage. That should give you a little clue.
The lens that I've seen on broadcast cameras looks like it's a very large piece of glass. Looks to me like it's capable of an F1.4 or whatever. And if the camera is typically 3 feet away from the subject, that combination of a big piece of glass and a close distance, if it was an ordinary photographic camera and I focused on that subject, the stuff in the background is going to be a blur. On television, nothing is a blur. I'm a bit amazed. Where's the magic happening, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, in Letterman's studio, the camera has pretty good sensitivity. There's actually what used to be Philips, now a company called Glass Valley. Those lenses are running, they're usually running, in that studio, they're running around F2 and a half. But there's only 20 to 30 foot candles of light coming off the subject. And when we talk about coming off the subject, it's reflective light, not incident light. When the cameras that I used to run at the studio, and you look at the incident light, and the light that's actually falling on the subject, we would try to shoot for about 100 foot candles, which is a fairly decent amount of light. So the fact that it's dark, so to speak, and that lens is wide open, and the depth of the studio, the wider you keep that lens open, the more uniform everything is when it finally hits the target of the sensor. So there really is no magic, it's just optics.
It seems to be operating opposite, though, from the photographic cameras I have used. If I open the lens to 1.4, and I'm doing a portrait with a 130mm lens, and I'm 4 feet from the subject, and I focus carefully on their eyes, objects 1 foot deep, further in depth or less in depth, are noticeably out of focus. And yet with these studio cameras, you're not getting that effect, and I'm wondering why. Over to you, Eric.
Now, you mentioned the size of the lens. I mean, the T numbers of those lenses tend to be like 0.7, 0.6. As soon as you bring them outside, then you wind up having to stop it down at F16, F20, because of the sensitivity of the cameras. And there, your depth of field is a whole different game, where that you're on a football stadium or a baseball field. When you focus on the foreground, which might be 40 or 50 feet away, the background, which is 100 feet away, is also in perfect focus. So it's a ratio between the size of the lens, the amount of light, and the size of the aperture.
Could I describe depth of field as the ratio of inner depth that starts falling out of focus and outer depth that starts falling out of focus? If I take one and divide it into the other, could I call that the depth of field number, Eric? Go ahead.
There actually is a formula for that. Now, I don't remember it off the top of my head, but there are a couple of parameters. And, you know, I can look that up and give you the specifics of it.
But when I take that 35mm old-fashioned photographic camera, and I take a picture indoors at f1.4, I got to be very careful with the focus. I go outside where it's bright and I got to stop down to F16. Boy, I can be sloppy as all hell and everything is in focus. I have a huge depth of field when I'm closed down to F16. And you seem to be telling me the opposite with the studio camera, and I'm a bit confused, as you can tell. Over to you, Eric.
Now I understand that. I think I used to be confused too, but on your Nikon, you have a little button. It's called a depth of field button. If you can't actually see the focus when you're in a dark area, you hit that button, everything gets darker, but you see what's sharp and what's not. Is that true?
Hey, your camera is more automatic than mine. The modulation transfer function, when you go into focus, the fine details start giving you a lot of high-frequency notes, so the modulation transfer function goes up. And so if the system dithers itself to focus to get the highest transfer function frequency, I can see that's automatic focus. However, I'm a little bit confused as to how it knows when it's out of focus, should it go out or in? How does it know which way to go if it starts off very far out of focus? Over to you, Eric.
Are you now talking about an autofocus camera?
Yeah, what I just described is an autofocus camera, and I presume it adjusts its focus until it's got the highest modulation transfer function for that particular scene. That's how it knows it has arrived. How does it know which way to go? A blind man knows how to walk up a hill because the tilt of his feet tells him which way is uphill. How does the autofocus camera know which way is uphill, if you know what I mean?
All right. That's a little bit like a tuner, like an antenna tuner. There's an algorithm, and some of them are good, some of them are not. And if you spend more money on a camera, like an Nikon or a Canon, you get a choice of five different or six different algorithms in which to work with. You have algorithms which actually look just at the center of the picture. You have algorithms that look at the edges of the picture. They weight it, and they say, well, this is a priority, so we're going to actually do our focusing based on this. We're doing portraits. We're going to actually try and do the center of the screen and just the center of the screen because that's where the subject is. And in terms of which way to go, they actually, if you were to slow down the camera and record the actual focusing process, you'll find it jitters.
Okay. So as long as it's dithering, it knows which way is better, and I accept that. It's going through a sine wave, so to speak. In the case of an automatic tuner, when your automatic tuner is tuned high or low, I'm being simplistic here, the reflected energy is either inductive or capacitive, leading in phase or lagging in phase. So in most cases with an automatic tuner, not all, the phase angle of the reflection of the standing wave ratio tells it which way to go. Optically, I don't think you've got phase angle, so you're getting it by way of dither, which is very similar to a kind of a radar that does tracking by what's called conical scanning. Over to you, Eric, K2LIW.
Now, I don't know what manufacturer you're talking about, but most of the Japanese ones that I've worked on, they essentially use just in essence, an SWR bridge, and if it's going lower, it goes the other way.
So you're saying the automatic tuners that are in most of our ham rigs are really very simplistic zither devices. They're not really measuring the phase angle of the visor. Go ahead.
Yeah. I don't know if anybody's ever made anyone way more sophisticated than that in the ham market, but I haven't seen it.
Now, measuring phase angle nowadays is nowhere near as difficult as you think. You have to detect the reflected signal to know when you've arrived. Once you've decided you're going to do a detection, to do a synchronous detection using the actual transmitted signal as the carrier is very simple. Once you've got a synchronous detector, you therefore get a positive or negative signal depending on whether it's leading in phase or lagging in phase. So measuring phase is nowhere near as difficult as it used to be. Over to you, Eric.
Oh, I am so aware of that with the broadcast transmitters. You know, the broadcast industry takes advantage of everything that everybody ever knew. But up until, I haven't been fixing ham radios too much lately, but most of the tuners actually work on an algorithm that, you know, the microprocessor is saying, okay, do this, let's see what happens. Oh, that's too far away. Let's try this. It's sort of like a guessing game, but it does it very quickly.
K2KE1.
Yes, because mine hunts all the time.
Some of them never stop hunting. All right, go ahead, Mel.
Well, I was going to say, some of this auto-tuners, you can hear them. They're constantly hunting. Now, I built one called the Easy Tuner that was featured in QST a few years ago with over a two-month feature, two halves to build it. And it's got a number of these ICs that now are called these, I think they call them PICs, PIC or something. I never understood the actual operation of the thing. It's got a couple servo motors in there. And it changes the inductance, this one, and the capacitance, rather than just switching by relay. So it does lock on and stays locked. That's what I am amazed at, the difference. And yet there's not, I don't think, one of them I ever seen on the market based on that principle. That's question number one. Then I want to ask you one more question, if you're talking about cameras, Dick. But if you want to make a comment on that, we'll... I'll let you pause for that, but then I want to ask you a question about a camera. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me ask Eric, the PIC, the thing that you burn that has the program in it, so to speak, there's a more formal name for that device, and I can't think of it. Over to you, Eric.
PIC as in processor? Well, it is a microprocessor with memory, and it's just a microcomputer as opposed to a microcontroller.
Okay, these great big arrays of diodes that you burn in order to make certain connections and certain functions work. What's the formal name for those devices?
Matrix.
Okay, it's got another name I can't think of. But I had the impression from what you built, Mel, that... by way of you properly programming that PIC device, the microprocessor, and by the measurements it made, that blind man knew which way to work up the hill. It wasn't dithering. In your case, it just went straight to the solution and locked in. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
I thought it was an interesting project. I liked the design of the tuner and everything about that, the components and everything. And I said, I really wanted a good quality tuner. I said, okay, worst comes to worst, I'll build it. I can always tune it manually, and you can. It's got that function, too. It's got the knobs on the front, and you see the knobs turning, everything turning, and you've got an indicator that tells you what is set for what, on the display. You get this little display that you put in there. I follow the directions, how this, person told you to put it together, how to the so-called program it, and everything works. Excellent. It took a little, as they say, careful workmanship and all, because it is a little bit on the complicated side to many amateurs. But I'll tell you, I just was quite impressed. And, I wanted to ask you a question about it, a camera. Go ahead, first pick up on this.
Hey, Mel, what kind of protective circuits did it have in it? Since you built it, you should know what's there. And who supplies the software for it?
The guy who designed it, you download whatever you needed from his website. The indicator, let me tell you about the indicator. This thing wound up costing a good few bucks because the indicator I'm using, in which he suggested when I purchased it, I didn't think that this thing was going to cost what it wound up costing. It's a bird indicator unit that it's a thing that takes two slugs. Did you ever see one with two slugs, Eric? Over.
Yeah, I have lots of them. They also make a fully electronic one with a digital display, and they make just the pass-through part. The part that goes through line into the. The coax and actually gives you the voltages out from both of the slugs. One slug you have in the forward direction, the other one you have in the reverse direction.
Exactly. But of course, a little bit is what it costs to build a thing like this. best thing on the market. It's a lot cheaper. All right, but all right, getting back to the camera. Let me let it drop. I want to ask you a question about cameras. Okay. I have here an old VHF videotape, you know, camera. You know, one of those big black ones that was put out by Panasonic that you push the button, the door snaps open on the side. It's got the viewfinder and all, and, you know, it's got the, it's a big old, it's a clunker, you know. It was clunker. It was about what? Not that old. What did they go back? Maybe 15 years ago? How does that autofocus on that thing? What is it? In other words, you're turning it, it's got that autofocus. You see the lens, that little motor inside driving that lens in and out. What the heck is it focusing on? When I'm looking at a scene in the room, it focuses up correctly. What is the scene, what part of the room scene is this thing sensing in? How is it doing it? Is right through the lens itself? I mean, or is it something to do with ultrasonics? I think there's some kind of pickup on there, an ultrasonic pickup of some sort. Am I correct?
You got it, Eric.
A lot of all the cameras, they use either infrared or ultrasonic, plus the actual output of video. Okay? The ultrasonic sensor would give it distance to the farthest object or the object that you're pointing at. That would say, no, my lens got to be about here. And then what it would do is look at the actual video and feed the video through a low-pass filter, no, a high-pass filter. And what it would do, it would actually adjust the lens to get the maximum amount of energy. It would cut off all the low frequency, just look at the high frequency. And as the lens would adjust a little bit, the high-frequency energy would increase and it would go for peak on that.
So, Eric, are you saying that the ultrasonic rangefinder was the coarse rangefinder and the modulation transfer function high-frequency component was the fine adjust on focus and probably it emphasized the center of the screen? Over to you, Eric.
That's correct, Dick. The only thing is that with the video cameras, which is different than the film-type cameras or the still cameras, especially in the older technology, you didn't focus on the center of the screen. It's just the whole average of the picture because you're talking about one line being 64 microseconds. There's a little thinking that's got to go on.
So you're saying that his still camera most likely looked at the whole scene and got the maximum high-frequency response by varying the focus, maybe by a slight dithering function, until the highest frequency components were maximized for the whole scene. Is that true, Eric?
If we're talking video cameras, still cameras have a little different approach.
The still camera tends to focus on the center, where the subject usually is, whereas the video camera looks at everything because you're about to wave it around. Is that the idea?
Well, you got to remember that digital still cameras are a more recent object. When we're talking about the VHS days, right, many of the cameras didn't have memory to store an entire frame to average out or to look at a particular portion of the picture. If you remember, Mel described the size of the camera. It tended to be completely analog devices. So the way you would do something in an analog device is you would actually take samples across an entire field and then average that out. So it would really be looking at the whole scene, not a particular part of the scene.
Now, I just experienced a weird camera effect. Kodak camera, 8-year-old type Kodak electronic camera. I wasn't smart enough to realize that the nickel metal hydride pair of AA cells that are in there, which are rechargeable, and they were going dead. I didn't realize that in a pinch I could simply substitute them with a pair of ordinary AA alkalines. Wasn't smart enough to realize this. I'm taking pictures of my son's master's degree graduation last weekend, I guess it was. And because the nickel metal hydride battery was down to the bottom, We discovered that it would take pictures, but it took pictures in a funny way. You lined up the subject, you aimed the camera, you pressed the button, and the camera would wait 6 seconds or so. Then it would take the picture. We found this out by the fact that the first three pictures we took, we ended up taking pictures of people's feet. We carefully focused the camera, we pressed the button, we assumed it took the picture, we waved the camera some other way, and all of a sudden, some time later, the picture appeared on the screen, and it was a picture of the people's feet. We suddenly realized it had a delay to it. And so now what we did is say, tell everybody, I just pressed the button, hold still, because the real picture is not going to be taken for another 6 seconds. 6 seconds later, we believe it took the picture. Sometime beyond that, the picture was recorded onto its medium, and it appeared on the screen. What in the world was going on with a 6 minute delay for it to freeze the frame? I mean, if it took 6 seconds to load it into the medium, I understand that. It didn't take the picture until roughly 6 seconds after we pressed the button. And we weren't using a time delay function that we knew of. Over to you, Eric, KQRIW.
No, I can always take a wild guess. I don't know how that camera's made, but because the voltage is low, you got to remember that the camera is still a mechanical device. The shutter isn't those cameras. It's a mechanical device. It's solenoid operated, so it may not have had enough voltage to pull with them shutter open, and that's what you were waiting for.
Okay, somehow it knew when it opened its shutter. It knew to turn on its electronics so that the mosaic got recorded, the CCDs or whatever. And we got beautiful pictures, but that delay was really annoying. We had to tell everybody, sit still, we're about to take a picture, and really sit still for a while. And all of a sudden we put in the AA cells and the problem went away. You probably got some more camera questions, so over to you, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Well, like I say, I never understood completely the operation of this. Now, I say the big, you know, this was the Panasonic, the VHF ones. Yes, I guess there was a lot of analog technology also in there. And but then they came out with, as they progressed before, it seems like the videotape died. You know, Sony started producing these, the C-type videotape. It was, the VHF one was the big cartridge, and then they came out with a smaller cartridge. The ones that they came out with, I think they're called C-type or D-type or whatever, smaller and smaller, and the cameras got smaller, the videotape cameras. And yet, they had this function, and I wondered, what in the heck are they doing that you can move this thing in and the response is so quick, to focus on that scene. And where in the scene, like you say, is looking, because, when you look at a scene like of a room, there's so many things, how is it actually gets the optimum of the scene of the looking in a room? In other words, it like knows what you're looking for, over.
Well, it doesn't know what you're looking for. Just remember that one field, not one frame. One field is a 60th of a second. You can't see that fast. I mean, you go to the movie theater and you watch what you think is 24 frames a second. But if you were watching 24 frames a second, you wouldn't have a happy time. When you go to the movie theater, every frame is projected twice, so that way you don't have any perceived flicker or variation in the image. Well, this stuff is happening 60 times a second, and it's making its adjustments before the persistence of your eye, it all happens before your eyeball senses it, so. And it's still just doing the average. Even today's autofocus camera, we went from the big VHS tape to VHS-C to what we call mini-DV. And also, by the way, the tape technologies have changed it from planet oxide to metal particle. The stuff is almost impossible to erase, the mini-DV stuff today. You can't put it through a regular old degausser. You've got to put it through a high-test degausser to make it go away. but we don't do that stuff anymore. Everything's on memory or DVD or whatever. But you got to remember the repetition rate at which things are happening, Mel, real quick.
Mel, I mean, Eric, image stabilization cameras, what percentage of the broadcast cameras have built-in image stabilization? What percentage of the cameras that I could buy, if I'm smart enough to buy a modern camera, or modern binoculars or whatever, what percentage of things have image stabilization techniques? I bet you they're getting pretty good. Over to you, Eric.
Okay. In the broadcast industry, image stabilized cameras you will find on cameras that have these huge lenses that take a picture of the golf ball as you're going by. But that's only a recent phenomena. But where you'll find 100% of image stabilization, like a SWEM gyro zoom, which actually has three gyros in it, which is home a prism constant, you'll find them in all the helicopters. You ever wonder why the helicopter shot doesn't wiggle around and or even on the Goodyear blimp? But in the studio, you'll find zero image stabilization. And in amateur cameras that you buy in the store, it's about 99% of them have either steady shot or some trade name of unshaken pictures, including the still cameras.
Wow. Now, you're calling it a gyro, and I'm guessing that what you're calling a gyro is not a rotating gyroscope. These are solid-state equivalents. In other words, there's a vibrating reed in there that's doing the gyroscopic function, and it's microscopic. That's my guess. So I think you're saying image stabilization these days is so inexpensive and small in real estate requirement that you're saying a high percentage of the things that I now buy have one form of image stabilization or another. I don't think the binoculars have it unless you pay some extra bucks, but I think you're saying the cameras have all got it. Over to you, Eric.
Okay, well, from GyroZoom, it's a trade name. It runs in the order of about $40,000 for the lens. It has three motors in it, okay? The steady shot, those kind of things, what they basically do is they overscan the sensor. When you take a picture, you're only using maybe about 7/8 of the sensor. And what we do is we electronically change the way we clock it out based upon motion. Some of the cameras will use the things that you have, you know, an acceleration chip like having your iPhone or your Android. The ones that are on the big lenses, those big mothers have big mother motors in them.
By big mother motors, I'm beginning to think you're saying real rotating gyroscopes. Is that what you mean, Eric?
That's why they cost so much.
Go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, I was going to say, on my Leica and my Hasselblad, I had a unit that it mounted on, which had three gyros in it, and you would plug that into a battery, a 12-volt battery, and bring them up to speed, and then you could shoot for a few minutes, and it held everything rock steady.
Nowadays, if I'm willing to buy expensive binoculars, Nikon, among other brands, some of them have image stabilization built into the binoculars or telescope. What's your guess as to how they're doing that, Eric?
Two methods. One is little tiny itsy-bitsy motors, which actually are on a gimbal mount, which actually runs a servo-controlled prism, and the other is with reeds. They have a vibrating, that's a three-axis vibrating reed, prism, which is mounted on a two-axis set of coils, kind of like the inside your DVD player. You've got two mirrors that are mounted on little magnets that have little voice coils around them, and they actually deflect it according to what the servo is telling it to do.
Solid-state memory devices we have these days in the thumb drives and whatever. I keep forgetting the name of this technique by which a tiny little capacitor in there, you put a charge on it and it lasts forever.
Thanks.
Say that again.
Flash memory.
Yeah. In the case of a flash memory, you're literally putting some number of electrons on a capacitor, and that is the bit of information. How in the world does such a tiny capacitor, which is a fraction of a picofarad, maintain that charge for the next 10 years? It would take 10 to the 20 ohms in order to not drain away that charge. How in the world do they get such small leakage capacitors and zillions of them? That is one hell of a technology. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, we had this discussion before. There's more quantum physics going on, and actually a little bit of change in the physical state of the layer of the semiconductor and the doping involved.
So I think you're saying there's a finite number of times I can charge and discharge that thing. In other words, I can overwrite it some number of times, and after that the bit error rate starts climbing?
That is correct.
What's your guess as to the number of overwrites I can get on a medium brand thumb drive?
We're getting into the millions these days.
So I can overwrite it millions of times before it starts degrading. Wow. What's the chances I'm likely to do that?
You're more likely to get an error from a cosmic particle than you are from overwriting it. Although if you go back to the days of the electrically erasable ROM, the EROM, they typically had a cycle time of maybe 500 to 1,000 shots and then time to throw them away.
But now these flash memories are millions of times. Wow. Is that field also following Moore's law? In other words, the number of flash memory bits that I can put per cubic centimeter, is that also doubling every 18 months?
Well, as you know, with semiconductors, we kind of hit a brick wall with electron lithography, where you can only make the circuit so small. It's the next great leap in technology that's going to get us into the, now you have carbon silicon transistors and stuff like that, which have a smaller footprint. But we still have to, and most people don't realize, when you look at an IC, somebody actually drew the damn thing out on a huge 20-foot by 30-foot piece of paper of the actual circuit and the transistors, and then all that has to get reduced down to a little piece of die. So, you know, Moore's law keeps going until we hit a wall, then we come up with a new technology, and then we keep going again.
WA2CVL Mobile, if you copy me.
We're copying you beautiful, Andy, and hopefully you're driving well. I got a quick last question here for you, Eric, and that is, Moore wrote his law or rule way back in 1967 or so, and lots of pessimists will say at that time, yeah, it's working for the last 5 years or the next 6 years, but it's going to run out of steam in 10 years. We've predicted this running out of steam of Moore's law 4 or 5 times in a row, and here we are 43 years later, and we haven't yet run out of steam. Are you telling me we're about to run out of steam except for some new breakthrough, Eric, go ahead?
No, I'm not telling you we're going to run out of steam. What happens is, and if you look through history, it slows down for a little period of time until somebody does a little research, and then all of a sudden it speeds up again. There was a time that, you know, electron beam lithography, which is the basis of all semiconductor creation, was not capable of producing a trace that was smaller than, what was it, the 10 microns, the 15 microns, and it took a little while for somebody to make a better machine and reduce the size of the spot, and then we're down to like 1 micron, and then et cetera, so on and so forth.
Well, there are some super high frequency transistors these days that have gate lengths of 70 nanometers, that's 0.07 microns, 70 nanometers and beyond. I presume that's electron lithography, is it not, Eric? Go ahead.
Yep, it is. We haven't come up with a better way to do it yet, but I think with the carbon nanotube technology that's coming around, they're actually being able to start to put stuff together on the molecule size. So, and that's by way of growing it rather than by way of, electrophotography, if you want to call it that.
WA2CDL, K2RIW in the tail end of the TechNet. Did you get a chance to do a Dance with the Bride tonight, Andy? Go ahead.
Yes, I did. Yeah, there was a lot of dancing. And they had a live band, which was nice. So, now I'm on the LIE, and coming up to exit 58. So, yeah, I see that the link, the repeaters are not linked, because I didn't know that you guys were still on. I couldn't hear the repeater, the 85 repeater out in, wherever I was, whatever town that was. Off the Wading River. I couldn't hear the 85 repeater because the other repeater was not linked. I didn't know you guys were still on. I came out to the car and I said, oh, I checked that off. It's over. But, didn't know that. Anyway, I'm gonna go home and get some sleep. Rather tired. I see a lot of cops out here tonight on the LIE. I guess they're looking for DWIs, especially since it's a holiday weekend. Eric, back to you. Over to you.
Yeah, Eric, does the 375 link turn off at a certain hour? Over to you, Eric.
No, it doesn't. It's what happens when it gets timed out. It drops, and actually, what's probably happening is that everybody on the IRLP is missing it because once you time it out, the thing won't reconnect. Usually I'm listening and I reconnect it, but I wasn't even being conscious of it. I forgot today was Sunday. I was working in the house, so. Actually, if we drop this, nobody talks for about 45 seconds, it'll automatically reconnect, but there's that chance of nobody talking for 45 seconds.
I'm wondering why it takes 45 seconds to reset, as opposed to before it drops, we will reset it if we wait, 5 seconds?
No, what happens when you time it out? It loses its connectivity to the reflector. And there's a program that runs that when the machine doesn't have a COR for a preset period of time, it will then automatically reconnect to the reflector. But, this being a TechNet, there'll never be more than, 10 seconds of silence.
Yeah, everybody wants to talk on top of each other. So, what's the next project, repeater-wise, for you and Andy? Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a lot of projects going, but I think Andy's more, has more activity at the moment because I'm too busy building a house.
So what is the next project, Andy?
Well, basically, we want to link the repeaters by RF rather than having the IRLP do it. So, hopefully this week, I can get out and install at least part of the network and then check it out, see how it's going to play. Yeah, that'll eliminate any timeouts and all the delays that happens, at least that. Don't know how it's going to work with IRLP or Echolink connected at the same time, but we'll see how it works out. And hope everybody has a nice Memorial Day. At least the weather held up. I had a little scare just a little while ago I'll tell you, let me let it drop. I'll tell you what happened. The place that I was just at with the wedding, where the wedding was, has two identical sides on each side of the building. There's a west side wing and there's an east side wing, and there were two identical parking lots, one east, one west. So I go out after the wedding and go into the parking lot, and I'm frantically looking for my car, and I did not bring my alarm button with me because I forgot it. Normally I would click the button and the car will make a noise and I would know the car is here. So I'm going up and down and up and down the parking lot and I can't find my car. My car is nowhere to be found. So I start to think to myself, wait a minute, what's going on here? So I go back inside and I said, my car's gone. And the lady said, did you check the other side of the building? And I said, no. She said, it's probably on the other side, and that's where it was. But if you look at the buildings, both sides are identical. So that's the way it turned out. At least my car is still here. Go ahead, Eric.
Your beeping device has what kind of range to the car? If you were 1,000 feet away, would it still beep at you, Eric? Andy?
I never checked the range, but a couple hundred feet, yes. I don't know about 1,000 feet. But 200 feet, maybe 300 feet, I would think so.
Dick, did you get my email? I just want to make sure I resend it.
I'll go take a look. Eric, go ahead.
What, are you passing it to me, Dick?
Yeah, I don't know who gets it now. We're just about to run out of time. So, this was TechNet number 1351. Be kind to each other. Mel, you might want to put in some closing words. K2KUY, K2RIW.
Just say goodnight to all, and don't forget what tomorrow is all about. Show your patriotism, put out a flag and all, and take a minute to reflect on the meaning of Memorial Day. 73 golf, hopefully we'll get together next week.
This is K2KUY. On the New England Reflector. I got some questions from you, Wesley.
Go ahead.
I got the question.
Okay. That video link to the over unity device.
Physics Stephen E. Jones shows over unity circuit and measurements. That's what I've got.
Yeah, there's supposed to be a link for it, and this is part one. And if you click on the top of that video link, when you get into the YouTube, you're gonna see the part two as well, or I can send it to you. It is interesting, and I would like to discuss it next week with you.
Roger, Roger.
Thank you very much, and I really appreciate for you to find the time to review that.
Okay, bye bye, you all. We're about to be cut off in a few seconds.
Thank you, Dick. Good night. Also, you too, Mel. Have a great day tomorrow, you guys. Wesley, talk to you down a lot.
KC2WGB. And you're going to go to 147 or you're going to go to bed?
I can go to 147 for a few minutes.
Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. Glenn, Eric. Oh, God. So many people to put on the list. It was a very nice evening as well. As always. Mel. 73, sir.
Good night, KUK.
Good night, Eric. Dick, you're still out there. Are you a wine drinker, sir?
Yeah. Negatory.